solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
I don't think there are many more elegant tennis players. I mean, he's a belly dancer out there in a lot of ways. He's also got the grit. There are other players who are beautiful to watch. Grigor Dimitrov. How many Grand Slams has Grigor won? None. So the elegance plus the excellence, the enduring quality, and the way he just connects with people, whether it's somebody, you know, unimportant like me or somebody who's like the sponsor who's going to give him a $100 million deal and or, you know, the friend of the friend who's a construction worker who wants to understand how you build a building. The way he connects with people, even though he's not somebody who's like a Nick Kyrgios who's going to go over and chat with the fan on the side of the stands mid-match, he connected with people throughout his whole career. And that's really the heart of it.
Welcome to the 100th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations on leadership, transitions, careers, and life. If you've been following the podcast, you know that this is a labor of love of mine. And first and foremost, it's a space where I get to learn and grow from some of the conversations with these leading minds. We're also possibly the only podcast in the world where we slice the conversation into smaller pieces of content that we call nuggets, cross-reference the insights into something that might have been said in a different conversation, and curate all that using tags that make the content easy to navigate. While you may not be able to see all these features when you consume the podcast on Apple or Spotify, if you went to playtopotential.com and saw the curated playlist section, you will see the nuggets organized by theme. That's playtopotential.com. Thank you for your support and love over the years, and look forward to having you as part of the journey where I explore these themes further in the years to come. While podcasting accounts for 10 to 20% of my time and effort, my primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a discrete sounding board for CEOs and entrepreneurs. I engage with leaders and organizations with a growth mindset and help them play to their unique potential. You can learn more about the podcast and my work at playtopotential.com. Given this is the 100th episode, we wanted to mark it with something special. So this time we have Christopher Clary of the New York Times. He's written the book The Master, The Brilliant Career of Roger Federer. Chris has covered global sports for the New York Times for more than 30 years, and he's one of the world's leading authorities on tennis and has reported from more than 100 Grand Slam tournaments, chronicling the major figures and issues of the Open era and interviewing everyone from Bjorn Borg to Serena Williams. Now, the numbers might say that Novak and Rafa have 22 each and counting. But for me, Roger is still the person that I personally consider as the greatest of all time in tennis. And it's hard to put a finger on what it is about him that really makes him so special for me. Whether it's the footwork of a ballet dancer, or the smoothness of the one-handed backhand, the naughtiness of a saber, sneak attack by Roger, his humor and charm during on-court interviews, or him breaking down like a child with Nadal during the last game of the Laver Cup. I guess it's some combination of the factors and much more. Talking to Chris Clary was the closest I could get to in terms of having a peek into Roger's life. Hope you like this episode. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Chris Clary. Chris, thanks so much for making the time. Really excited to have you at the Play to Potential podcast.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I'm really delighted to join you, and I appreciate the interest.
Lovely. And maybe just to kick things off, how's the book doing? What's been the reception?
Well, Deepak, it's been really gratifying. It's been a bestseller on the national level, I think, in six different countries, and it's had sold over 100,000 copies around the world so far. In its year of existence, came out in paperback in the U.S. and the U.K., and it's just been, you know, a full tribute to Roger's reach, not my writing, but Roger's reach. And I think it's been, I think it came out at a very good time as well. I mean, nobody was wishing Roger any ill fortune, but the fact that he didn't play much when the book was released and then ended up retiring a year later, I think the timing of it, people were in a nostalgic mood, have wanted to read about Roger's path and his journey. And I think most interesting thing for me really has been how many young people have connected with it, because they really didn't know Roger's whole story. They didn't know his whole evolution. Hmm. And that's some of my most interesting conversations have been with people that are, you know, sort of 35 and younger, that talk about just how they had no idea Roger was never anything but this elegant gentleman on court who had a perfect comportment and always was an angel and beautiful leader. And really, as if you read the book and know his story, as a lot of us who are older do, it wasn't always like that. So I think it's been interesting to share that and see that land and resonate with a new audience.
Fascinating. And maybe in terms of context, Chris, if you want to give the listeners a sense of your, let's say, journey with Roger. In the book, you talk a little bit about the number of different occasions where you've had an opportunity to spend time with him, sit across with him. If you want to give us a sense of just the cumulative window you've had into his journey and his career.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been a sports writer for over 35 years. I've been covering tennis almost from the start. I was a mediocre college player in the U.S. I was always drawn to the game. It felt very natural to write about it. And I really understood how hard it was to hit the shots that these guys were hitting because I couldn't hit them. So that's just the connection with it. And I had been in the business covering, you know, top level tennis for about a decade when Roger emerged. And I just heard so many, you know, positive reviews of his potential. So I was always very interested in watching him play. And, you know, frankly, wasn't always so sure about what he would achieve in the early years. But we first did an interview in Basel, Switzerland, where he's from. It was in 2001. And he almost single-handedly destroyed the U.S. Davis Cup team. I went there to Basel to write about Patrick McEnroe's debut as the U.S. Davis Cup captain. Ended up writing about Roger, you know, being this phenomenal talent who was coming into his own. You could just see from that match and that experience that he was ready to do great things in the game. He was starting to put it all together. So I was very curious about him. And in those days, he was already speaking to the press in Swiss German and English and French, as he did throughout his career. So to see him then kind of in a rough mode, he wasn't anywhere near as well-groomed or as polished at that point, but he already had that sort of international reach to him. And he was very engaging, very real. And over the years, because of my job with the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times, I spent a lot of time internationally covering all types of sport, but a lot of tennis. And we just developed a longstanding professional connection. And we would pretty much do an interview every year in depth throughout his whole career. And I didn't follow him as a youth, but I followed him pretty much through his whole professional career. And we did well over 20 interviews in depth over the years. Just did most recent one was after he retired after the Laver Cup a few weeks ago. And, you know, it's not a friendship by any means, nor should it be in journalism, but it was definitely and has been a really rich connection. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, I was overseas. I could connect with him as a European player. And because I had covered, I think, Pete Sampras, Andre Agassi, Michael Chang, Jim Courier, Ed Berg, those guys before Roger emerged, I had a really good understanding already of sort of the men's game and the elite level. So I think there was a nice point of contact there. And honestly, it's been in my long career, one of the very best connections I've ever had with a professional athlete, just in terms of his willingness to talk about his mindset, his experiences, the regularity of it, the in-depth nature of it. Roger's not a guy to cut an interview off. He usually lets it run its course. And a lot of the interviews with him feel more like conversations, to be honest.
And going back to one of the things you said, Chris, 2001, people were already talking about his potential. Can you give us a sense of what people saw at that stage for them to say he'd be a special player?
Well, to be honest, I mean, the potential chatter began well before that. It began in the mid-1990s in European tennis circles. You talked to Régis Brunet, who was his first agent with IMG, watching him play in a junior tournament in Florida when I think he was 13 or 14 years old and literally sprinting to the payphone, which tells you how old this story is and how long Roger's been around in the game. He ran to a payphone in Florida and called his contact to get a hold of Roger's parents back in Switzerland because he was so excited by what he saw. And what he saw was somebody with just fluid movement, amazing shot-making potential, phenomenal hand-eye coordination, just an overall sort of kinetic chain to his tennis that was exceptional. And if you've watched enough tennis, that comes jumping off the court at you as you watch him play. And they can also see the athleticism and the speed and the quickness that he had. And as he developed, the real question was about his attitude and his emotional outbursts and behavior and self-criticism and whether that would hold him back, because it definitely held him back from achieving that full potential in his teens and very, very early 20s. But then again, how many of us in our teens really are the best version of ourselves? Probably not too many.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. While this is the 100th conversation at the podcast, I should point out to you that the very first conversation in the podcast was also about tennis. The guest at that time was Vijay Amritraj, the legendary Indian tennis player. I remember meeting him at the departure terminal at Mumbai Airport and walking up to him to request a conversation when this podcast was just an idea in my head. I remember it was a Monday morning. I was going to Chennai and he was headed to Bangalore. I still remember the look he gave me when I asked him if I could interview him for a podcast. I could see two questions in his eyes. One, who are you? And two, what the hell is a podcast? You know, 6-7 years back, podcasting was not quite a thing in those days. I was lucky that he was able to get comfortable with my intent in a couple of minutes. And before boarding, he told me that he was staying at the Leela in Bangalore for a week and he'd have time on Thursday. 3 days later, I just dropped everything else, booked my flight to meet him and record that conversation. When I look back, really, really grateful to see how far this podcast has come from that long shot a few years back with Vijay. While it's hard not to get impressed when you see precocious talent in front of you, like what Chris says about Roger's fluidity on court, I think it's useful to keep in mind that celebrating precocity sometimes can be tricky. Vijay gives a useful counterpoint that brings in the dimension of effort and commitment.
In certain cases, it's fairly clear that you can tell, especially when the kid is anywhere from 8, 9, 10 up. You could possibly, in certain cases, it's clear. But that doesn't mean he's going to make it or she's going to make it. That's where the rub comes. Mm-hmm. Just because on a scale of 1 to 10, your talent quotient is a 9, doesn't mean you're going to make it. And the other side of the coin is, if talent quotient was a 1, that doesn't mean you're not going to make it. The best examples of those are the fact that hard work will overcome lack of talent any day of the week and twice on Sunday. But lack of work is not going to help an extremely talented guy make it to the top in the similar fashion. So hard work is a necessity whether you like it or not. There's no shortcut to greatness. But at the end of the day, for some people it comes a little easier and some people it takes longer. With John McEnroe, what he could do in 30 minutes took Ivan Lendl 1 week to do. Mm. But they both did it. And they both became two of the greatest players the game has seen over my lifetime. Both world's number one. So I think it can be overcome. So just because you look at a child and he or she is not able to do A, B, and C, and of course mine was the perfect example as I was growing up, because on a scale of 1 to 10, I was probably a minus 1. And so you can't say, as all the pundits did at the time, or don't waste time, effort, and money on this child because he's not going to be good at anything. But then, you know, you can, you know, overcome most of these obstacles if there is that will and that belief and the people to be able to help you get there. So I think those things are probably the ones to be looking at, as opposed to saying, oh, he or she can or cannot make it.
I guess one of the most common examples that gets quoted in this context is Sachin Tendulkar versus Vinod Kambli. Several people say that in terms of intrinsic potential, when they were school kids, Kambli was possibly more gifted than Sachin. In that legendary match in 1988, when they played for Shardashram Vidya Mandir, they struck a partnership of 664, and in that match, Sachin scored 326 not out and Kambli scored 349 not out. We now know how their journeys played out. Anyways, you get the drift. Let's now get back to the conversation with Chris Clary. I want to take it back to parenting, Chris. Given the various conversations you've had with him and your understanding of his journey, what do you notice about the parenting he was exposed to with Lynette and Robert? Any aspects of the parenting that stand out for you?
Well, I haven't really done in-depth interviews with Lynette and Robert. I talked to both of them early in Roger's career when they were more accessible. But I've talked to many people about their way of doing things, and I've talked to Roger about it. And I think it's a combination. I'd say a couple different levels. One is that we're talking about Switzerland here. And Switzerland does not have a real culture of hero worship or sports star, superstar worship. It's not really part of the Swiss mentality. So Roger kind of grew up in this situation where even though he was a fabulous talent, he wasn't going to be put up on a pedestal like a guy like Lionel Messi might have been in Argentina, or Cristiano Ronaldo would have been, or you know, maybe Novak Djokovic in Serbia as time went along. Different situation. That's part of it. I also think that, you know, Robert and Lynette had lives of their own. They were successful people. Robert was an executive with a pharmaceutical firm. You know, he's an engineer by training. His mom has a very strong personality, a lot of charisma, a lot of confidence, wanted to raise a good human as well as a good athlete. The human was more important to them, I think, than the athlete all along. And they raised Roger to behave himself and to respect other people and to respect his workspace or his colleagues. And I think that's all part of it as well. Yes, they watched plenty of his tennis. And also Robert and Lynette were also very involved in Roger's career early in his pro career when he separated with his agents, Regis Brunet and the IMG team that I mentioned before, and began to kind of run things in-house. Mirka, who became his wife, actually was his press liaison during that period. So he used to call Mirka or text Mirka to get an interview with Roger. So things have definitely changed there. But I think Robert and Lynette in the Swiss culture, and the fact that Lynette is South African by birth, not Swiss. So there was an international kind of meeting of cultures already in the Federer household. Switzerland being a fairly international place anyway, and Basel being a city right on the border with France and Germany. Roger grew up with many different cultures kind of mixing in his own house as well as outside his front door. And I think he was very comfortable navigating in international waters after that. And a lot of that has to do with his parents exposing him to all that at a very early age.
I loved what you said. For them, raising a good human being was probably a notch higher than raising a great athlete. So I guess that sort of, in a way, explains a lot of elements of parenting.
There's a lot of good stories about, I don't know all the stories about Lynette. I'm sure there are plenty of those, but Robert was the one who, you know, would sort of, when he was with his son playing tennis, because Robert and Lynette are both avid amateur tennis players who came to the game later in life. And really, their enthusiasm, I'm sure, was one of the reasons why Roger gravitated to tennis. But there's stories of Robert sort of making his son walk home from the club because he was acting up during their matches, unable to control himself, and making him take public transport back instead of giving him a ride. There's a famous story of him coming back from a junior tournament, and Roger wouldn't stop complaining in the back of the car. And this is not very 21st century, at least not in our countries for parenting, but Robert gets out of the car and buries Roger's head in the snow to cool him off and get him to stop complaining. So I think there was some tough love involved, but I think there were some clear guidelines and parameters put in place by the Federer parents. And honestly, as a professional sports writer who's covered a lot of tennis, you've seen a lot of enabling behavior from parents over the years, not just in tennis, obviously in many, many sports, and probably in many academic disciplines as well, where if a child has an exceptional talent, the parents will cut them too much slack and you end up with a better talent than you do a human. But I think the Federers, at least by all the evidence we've seen from the outside, you never know how things happen when the doors are closed, but all the evidence of Roger being in the public eye for 20 plus years, all the conversations I had for this book, I think they did a good job of producing a pretty good human too.
And one of the things that struck me was in the book, you say that Robert also told him, given it's a low odds profession, that if you don't get into the top 100 by the time you're 20, then you might as well come back and, you know, pull up your socks and focus on academics. Do you have a view on that? Because sports also is not an easy profession to make it commercially viable. So any commentary on how they thought about that at different points in time?
Yeah, that was a family thing, but also I think it was a Swiss thing. Swiss culture, as I said, I think is a culture where sports are secondary to academics. I believe Indian culture in many ways is similar to that.
True.
And a lot of Asian culture as well is similar to that. And I think it was very much the case in Switzerland that, you know, pro athletes were rare, especially the exceptional kind, and the country had traditional values. And there was a sense that maybe sports was not 100% serious, unless you were a skier. Maybe that's different there, because that's obviously a holy land for them, the snow and the alpine skiing. But I think the tennis world was one that they were just kind of getting exposed to at the elite level. Martina Hingis, who was an immigrant, had just become number one in the world in the women's game just not long before Roger began to emerge. So there was definitely some quality in the Swiss tennis world, but not a lot of confidence from many parents that this was going to be a real path to a profitable long-term career. And I think Robert Federer is a businessman and somebody who understood risk and reward, was very attuned to the fact that his son needed to have a very strong backup plan. And he did a lot of discussion with agents and people who knew the game well. And I think his conclusion was, if Roger didn't arrive at X, which was that top 100 position within, I think, 3 or 4 years from turning pro, then it probably wasn't going to happen. And because Roger stopped school at 16, his parents are both well-educated. It was important to them that, you know, Roger get his degree if he wasn't able to become a pro tennis player and get that education on the road, that, which is true about tennis. He definitely has a school of its own with all the international travel and all the meetings. And I think Roger took full advantage of a lot of that. Some players don't, but I think he really did.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. This reminds me of an insight from Paddy Upton, mental conditioning coach of the Indian cricket team that won the ODI Cricket World Cup in 2011. With Dhoni hitting a last ball six in Wankhede. Paddy speaks about how Sachin Tendulkar's father would obsess about who he was as a human being as much as he would obsess about developing his cricketing capabilities.
In fact, Sachin told a story of himself when he first made the Indian cricket team as a 16-year-old. And when he came back from that tour, one of his teammates and very good friends saying to him that, you know, Sachin, we recognize you're a better cricketer than us, but since you made the Indian team, you're acting as if you're a more important person than us. And as a group of friends, we don't like that. And Sachin highlights that as one of the high moments or in his career, one of the most significant, moments in his career, when he was really able to realize the difference between being a good cricketer and being a human being, where, yes, he was a great cricketer, but it doesn't mean that he is now a great human being or superior or more important human being to his friends. And at the time, he also mentioned that his father had spoken to him about that, you know, your results on the field, people will very quickly forget them. If you score 100 and you score the naught the next week, they'll forget your 100. Or you score a naught and you score 100 the following week, people will forget that. But they will always remember the impact you have on them as a person. So from a young age, his father had delivered that message. Then it was reinforced as a 16-year-old by his friends saying, who you are as a person is separate from the results you achieve on the sports field.
I've come to realize that while talent and hard work takes you to the top, what determines staying power is the values of the individual, which more often than not have been shaped by early years and by parenting. I also loved another point that Chris makes when he speaks about how Robert and Lynette set Roger a goalpost when he decided to pursue tennis. If you don't get into the top 100 by the time you're 20, you might as well come back and focus on academics. There's something to be said about how you give the long rope and where you keep the safety net for the child as they grow up. Something similar came up in my conversation with Atul Kasbekar, one of the celebrated photographers in the country, the man behind the Kingfisher calendar. He was actually studying chemical engineering at UDCT, one of the top chemical engineering colleges in India. He says that he picked chemical engineering because he liked chemistry. Very quickly, he figured out that chemical engineering had nothing to do with chemistry and wanted to go to photography. He shares what his father said at that point in time.
And even though, to give due, absolute due credit, even though he couldn't afford it at that time, my dad insisted that, okay, you, whatever education you want is not a problem. You figure out which is the best place in the world to go to, and I'll send you there. I was like, but you can't afford it right now, you know. So, and he's saying, shut up, that's none of your business, you know. And, but this is your long rope, because the education is everything. The receipt I want for it, he always had this thing about a degree.
Yep.
So I said, you know, photography, I don't really need a degree. I can assist people, I can learn, etc. He said, no. I want a degree to make myself happy. The degree is my receipt for the money I'm spending.
Very interesting.
Okay, so you give me my receipt. I don't care what you do with this.
As a parent, I've done my best to equip you for whatever.
So it was a great line. He said, look, you know, this is your long rope. Now you come up with it or you hang yourself is up to you. Okay, but I'm giving you that long rope. And after I've taken care of your education and your sister's education, etc., your mother and I will studiously spend your inheritance. Which I thought was a very cool thing. And I have, that's one of the few lines I have brutally used with my kids. Kya padhna hai batao? Okay, you get that one shot of the title. After that, good luck, buddy. You know, and if you need me to make phone calls, I'm more than happy to make them. Need me to stand guarantor for something, I'm happy to do that. But you know, I mean, it's, you go on your journey now.
Got it.
And then that safety net right now, which is right under your ass, you know, for my kids, I will move that now 30 feet below.
Got it.
And then further below, and then take it away.
I guess as our kids grow up, they are much more likely to make unorthodox choices in the way they think about passion and opportunity. How we think about supporting their passion and ambition while taking care of the risk is a tricky tightrope. Something for us to learn from these journeys here. If you want to tune into the conversation with Atul Kasbekar and Paddy Upton, you can just go to playtopotential.com and look up the guests section there. That's playtopotential.com. Let's now get back to the conversation with Chris Clary. I think the one thing that really struck me in the book was you say that one habit that separates Federer from most other elite athletes I've encountered is that he will ask about you first and not in a perfunctory manner, inquiring about your journey to the particular place, your own perceptions of the tournament, the country, the people. What struck me was he is a extremely curious individual. Can you talk about that element of his personality and the way it comes across as a journalist?
It is quite surprising in a way, because this is not somebody who was a brilliant student. He might have had good aptitude, I don't know, but his performance in school was not particularly exceptional. He was somebody who I think got distracted easily. His priority was on sport, and not somebody who particularly enjoyed sitting in the classroom, from what I understand anyway, and digging into the books. I feel like he was almost a hyperactive child in some ways, which has served him well in the sports world, but probably didn't serve him well in the classroom. And maybe I think he'd agree with that. And yet, because of the kind of life he was going to lead, with its international aspects, all these different types of people you're going to meet across all different levels of society, from the players to the agents to the sponsors, often very wealthy, successful people at a high level and much older. It's a wide range of personalities you're going to come across. And I think Roger decided early, either after consulting with his parents or his own natural way of being, that he was going to try to learn from people that he met along the way and not just give information grudgingly about himself or sort of be a passenger in this journey. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be active. And so my sense of him as a journalist, obviously I didn't know him when he was 15. I met him when he was 19, was he was already on that journey, trying to find out from people that he came across, you know, how does this work? How does your job, you know, what do you actually do? You know, where else have you been this week? And who else have you met? What else do you like? It wasn't like he was going on for 20 minutes about this, but he was curious to kind of place you and learn about, you know, where you fit into the ecosystem.
Hmm.
And I think he has a good sense about people. He made good choices about the people that he trusted along the way. He showed loyalty, but maybe not too much loyalty along the way, which was probably good. You need to keep refreshing your group. But I think in terms of the way he comes across many of the athletes that you meet over the years, it's kind of a one-way conversation. And it really is an interview where you feel like you're extracting information sometimes. Hmm. And Roger, it was definitely more two-way than hardly anybody else I came across. And also you just sense in his demeanor and his, he'd sit down and he wouldn't like cross his legs and his body and close himself off. He was open, you know, relaxed body language, open to conversation. Somebody I think who enjoyed human contact and enjoyed sort of that dialogue with whomever it might be. And I know it's not just journalism. I mean, you could say, well, it's PR. Well, sure it is. Sure, it's PR. He's somebody he knows the New York Times can be helpful to him and raise his profile as a Swiss tennis player and maybe down the road earn him some money, for sure. But then you hear stories about him talking to friends of friends who were construction workers, or I've heard a couple of these stories where, you know, Roger meets somebody through somebody else where it could just be a handshake and it turns into, so yeah, how do you actually do construction? How do you build a house? How do you do these things? This is not the usual superstar athlete behavior from my experience anyway.
And in the book, you talk about his growth mindset, right? You talk about In one of the sections, you talk about the feedback from Coach Adolf Kachowski, I hope I pronounced it right, who said that he'd never seen a junior who could apply his feedback so quickly. You know, can you share a little more about Roger's sort of that growth mindset, sort of curiosity towards others being one facet of it, but if you were to sort of expand on just his willingness to grow, learn and grow, are there a few other themes that stand out about how he went about learning?
Well, I mean, I think genius is a is an overused word we should use very carefully, but I do think Roger is a tennis genius in a sense. He's his physical capacities plus sort of his ability to translate mind's eye to action, it's genius level. It's such a rarity. And that was what struck, I think, Regis Brunet as he ran to the payphone. I think that's what struck a lot of people over the years. But the people working with him day to day, I've heard that from all of his coaches, that Roger, if you explain something to him, he could execute it very, very quickly. And not just tennis, other skills and other sports as well, too. Somebody who had a very, very quick learning curve. And I think he's also somebody who, you know, Marc Rosé, who used to be the leading Swiss player on the men's side before Roger came along, sort of talked about, you know, Roger's vision, his ability to sort of see the whole court, the whole playing field, and to process information quickly in a physical sense, much more quickly than any other player he'd come across in tennis. He compared him to Messi or Michael Jordan, people like that who are able to take all the information that's flying around them and almost slow it down because what they're experiencing is because the way they're processing that input, it actually seems to give them more time to do things. And it's a wide range of skills we're talking about here. The idea of being a quick learner maybe isn't directly related to that, but I do think it's indirectly related to that. And I think Roger's ability to take in input and then physically act it out is exceptional. And I think he was at that age, particularly in his early life, which was when Adolf was coaching him before Peter Carter came along in Basel, it was just a sense that Roger had a short attention span. And so you better keep him you better keep him interested. You better keep it lively and keep it varied. And I think all of his coaches along the way recognized that and catered to it. Obviously, as Roger hit his 30s, I'm sure that wasn't as much of a necessity as it was when he was in his teens and 20s. But I think the fact that people recognized that and maybe he recognized it in himself, it helped him acquire a lot of skills quickly. And they just kept churning it out and giving him new things to do.
Hmm. And one of the facets I want to talk about is his inner game, right? The mental game. You alluded to it some time back. I mean, he did have quite a bit of talent that was spotted at an early age, but sort of the how he handled himself mentally, there was room for growth and transformation. And one of the phrases you say in the book struck me. You say that Peter Carter and Peter Smith worked on it as a long-term project rather than treating it as a quick fix. Can you talk a little bit about his journey with the mental game, especially the crucial phase where he could have probably gone in a different direction?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the book does focus on that journey. To me, as a writer, it was the most interesting part. And honestly, I knew that there had been a transformation, but I really didn't know all the particulars of it, and I didn't know to what degree he really tried to tackle it, and how those around him tried to tackle it. And basically, the problem was focus, expectation, self-criticism. I think Roger, as anyone can attest who watches him after a big victory or a big defeat, with the emotions that he shows, obviously an emotional, sensitive person, very empathetic. And that empathy has probably a flip side for an athlete, in that you're feeling everything going on and it's hard to manage all of that. So I think early on, some of the meltdowns Roger had, tears after junior defeats. There's a story of him at the club in Basel, old boys, from another one of the early coaches saying that they would, you know, finish the tournament and all the other kids had grabbed their lunch and gone into the clubhouse to eat their picnic. And Roger was still underneath the umpire's chair crying, had to be gone out and fetched and sort of convinced it was okay to come back in. So that, yes, we all mature, we all change in that regard, but that essence of a person is there from an early age. So that was Roger's battlefield, really, was to find a way to channel all that, to use it for good, not for evil. And it's a long journey, but I think to sort of sum it up, basically Peter Carter and other people who coached him, Peter Carter was an Australian coach who ended up in Basel. He was a journeyman pro with a game very similar to Roger's, with the one-handed backhand, elegant strokes. A lot of what Roger Federer is on the court has to do with Peter Carter's influence from an early age and the way he taught him the game. But Peter was a second father. Roger has a father, but a second father for him in a lot of ways. And he recognized that, you know, Roger needed to find a way to master this part of his personality to play his best tennis. And ultimately it took Roger, I think, realizing that as well, that the kind of blow ups, the shouts, the toss rackets ultimately hurt him. There are a few players out there who it actually helps. I mean, you think about a guy like John McEnroe. I'm convinced that Novak Djokovic sometimes benefits too from outbursts that allow him to kind of exercise some of these demons and then move on. Roger wasn't like that. I think it really hurt him and knocked him off his game. So he knew he had to manage it. And I think they did it through a variety of manners. They did it through early use of a sports psychologist, a guy named Christian Marcoli, who was a former professional soccer player from Switzerland, who had very, very engaging guy. Did it through Pierre Paganini, who was a huge influence on Roger, who was his fitness trainer from pretty much the beginning of his pro career all the way through. Still is today, even in retirement, I'm sure. Also worked with Stan Wawrinka. And Pierre is kind of a philosopher king. He's somebody who talks about fitness in a very profound way. It's not just go do that sprint or go do that. There's always a method and reason behind it. And I think he really became a close confidant of Roger's and helped him work through his emotions. And I think there's a natural maturity that goes with it too. But ultimately what happened was Roger around 2001, 2000, clearly had a huge talent. He was already a factor on the ATP tour. He was finished fourth at the Olympics in Sydney in 2000. He won his first title early in 2001, destroyed us in Davis Cup, as I said, in 2001.
And he'd beaten Pete Sampras that year in the quarterfinals, didn't he?
Yeah. And after that, he came on and beat Pete Sampras in the fourth round at Wimbledon. It was a big breakthrough match for him. And he showed all that talent that you could see already earlier in the year. It was coming together for him. And yet, it was not from there to dominance. There was a two-year period where it still wasn't happening. And there were other people in the game like Andy Roddick, Juan Carlos Ferrero, who now coaches Carlos Alcaraz, Leighton Hewitt, of course, who already was number one at that time, Murat Safin. These were all guys who could have been the guy for a long time. And instead, it turned out to be Roger, and then Rafa, and then Novak. But what happened was, I think Roger realized for him to be able to reach his potential, he had to find a way to make that final step. He'd been working on his mental game and controlling his temper for a long time, but he knew that he had to go the next step and really, really make it happen in order to be able to play his best tennis and compete with these guys who were very talented and very good and had early edges over him in their rivalry as well. You watch some of those early Leighton Hewitt Roger Federer matches from 2001, 2000, 2002. Extraordinary matchup. And Leighton got the better of him quite often in some of those matches. So I think Roger realized he had to find a way to channel all that emotion and energy inside himself. You see the occasional sort of fist pump, but generally it's very smooth, very sedate, very self-contained. He wears a mask on court. And that's not Roger Federer. That's not who he really is deep down. He had to change, I think, his overall character and personality and the expression of his tennis in order to play his best tennis. And honestly, that's a bit rare, Deepak. I think often we think, okay, your tennis reflects your character, reflects who you really are. In Roger's case, the elegance, the movement, all that, of course, but that fiery person inside, you don't see that on the court very often.
And in that context, you also say, right, tennis is a sport where there's a lot of downtime between rallies, right? Rallies are only about 30 odd percent of the total time spent on the court. And more than half the time is spent in the head. If we talk about match situations, do you have an insight into how Roger manages the time when he's not playing a point?
Well, I think it's actually much more than half the time. You think about it. I mean, depends how long your points last. If you're baseline grinder, maybe so. But if you're trying to do it in two or three shots, like Roger often did, it's a lot of time to walk around. And Christian Marcoli, the psychologist who worked with him when he was young, that was his observation. I said, what's the most challenging thing about tennis? Because Christian's worked like many sports psychologists in many different sports. And he goes, that's the hard thing, is that there is so much time between points to mess yourself up, to think about things that can trouble you. And it really is, for him, about controlling a tennis player's time management and thought management during that period. I don't know precisely what Roger did all through his career, but I know in those early years, they worked on things like where your eyes are during a match between points, because with a crowd there and pointing on the other side of the net and a cheer umpire and maybe family and friends, it's easy to let your eyes wander to other parts of the court and get distracted. And Roger often would kind of go off the boil for long periods of time in matches that he was dominating early in his career. I know that he and Christian worked on trying to keep his focus on his strings, on the area just around him, to keep himself in that bubble. And a lot of Roger's work, I'm sure, in the mental game was focused on trying to keep himself contained, because as he is, as an extrovert, gregarious person, he's easily distracted, I think, and easily drawn to the wider community in his tennis matches. And I think he was able to learn to channel that and keep his focus really on the ball in play and the point at hand.
True. I mean, back to the earlier point you said, if you're curious as a person, then your natural instinct is to sort of look, absorb what's going on around you and to sort of contain that and to sort of really stay in that bubble, as you say, either between points or when you're sort of sitting under the umpire every two games, sort of keeping your attention, it can be quite challenging, I can imagine.
Yeah, and I'll think about best of five sets. You're playing 3 to 4 hours, almost 5 hours sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's a long, long time to be sitting in your school chair trying to do your homework there.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. It's fascinating to see how players manage idle time during a match when they're not actually playing. Even in a sport like cricket, if one looks at percentage of time when a batsman is active, it's possibly even smaller than tennis. How the batsman manages his inner voice becomes all the more critical, especially when there's sledging going on. Back to tennis, it's interesting how Roger dealt with this phenomenon. Another element that could help in these situations is rituals. Ethan Cross, author of the book Chatter, which is all about handling the inner voice, speaks about how Rafael Nadal would handle the same issue.
What was the hardest thing he struggled with on the tennis court? And his answer surprised a lot of people, because he didn't say the hardest thing he struggled with was maintaining his endurance or returning his opponent's backhand. It was managing the voice inside his head, right? It was the game that was the most difficult component for him. And if you've ever watched him play, you actually know what he does to manage that chatter. Nadal is famous for engaging in elaborate rituals. So from the time he walks onto the court, how he carries his bag and walks to his bench, to the way he positions his water bottles, to the routines he engages in before every single serve, he's highly ritualistic. And when asked why he does that, he has said, and something to the effect of, I order my surroundings to match the order I seek in my head.
If this topic is of interest, do look up my conversation with Ethan Cross for a deeper dive into how we can handle the inner voice. You can just go to playtopotential.com and find him in the guests section. That's playtopotential.com. Let's get back to Chris Clary now. I want to go back to Pier Paganini, right? His fitness coach. And you say that he's possibly been a key contributor to his longevity. And one of the themes that really strikes me about Roger is playing the long game, right? He's sort of, apart from the awards he's won and the titles he's won, what strikes me is just some of his statistic around the number of games he's completed without retiring hurt, the fact that he's played for so long at that level. Can you talk a little bit more about how he's managed to play the long game? What are some of the choices he might have made? And what's Pierre's approach? What can we learn from it?
Yeah, I think some of the things that Roger did are directly applicable to all of our lives in a lot of ways. But I think he and Pierre, who, as I said, he met Pierre when he was at in the town of Écublens, which is on Lake Geneva, which is where the Swiss National Training Center was. Roger went there when he was 14 years old, left home in Basel, left his parents for a couple of years to go down there as a boarder during the weekdays. And Pierre was running the fitness program there. So they met very early in Roger's life and formed a deep connection. And when Roger reached number one in the world, which was in early 2004, after winning the Australian Open, he'd won Wimbledon the year before as first major, and then he won the Australian Open to kind of back that up. He said that he and Pierre sat down and talked about, okay, how do I think long-term here? How do we structure my career, my schedule so I can last? And Roger wanted, he loved the game so much, and he had a clear vision that he was going to be able to play for a long time and be a factor for a long time. And he wanted to understand through Pierre's fitness expertise how to do that. And some of the conclusions that they made now seem self-evident, and many have adopted them. But one of the key things was periodization, where you're sort of, tennis as a sport is insane. I mean, it never ends. They basically have, you know, different times, 3 weeks off at the end of the season, a month off at the end of the season if you're a men's pro. That's hardly any time at all to reconstruct your game or to really recover physically enough after 11 months of globetrotting and intense competition. So they decided they would take the breaks, you know, meaningful breaks during the season itself and miss some events, which is one of the reasons why Roger basically stopped playing Davis Cup most of the time early in his career. After kind of that, after number one ranking was achieved, he decided that's what had to go, and a few of the tournaments had to go. But they tried to build a block of training in the spring and in the summer where he was not competing. He was working on his game, refreshing his body, and that was, and not playing too many tournaments throughout the year. That's a great system if you're a brilliant tennis player who wins a lot, because then you don't need to play that many tournaments. For an average journeyman pro to make a living, you need to play 30, 35 events a year to make the money you need. So Roger was in that privileged position to know he had that position in the game. He had the talent to be able to play fewer events and succeed in all of them and get the points he needed for his ranking. But that was very conscious on their part. And I think, you know, hand in hand with that was he realized very early that when he did show up on tour, he needed to be in the right frame of mind. And those breaks helped him in that department, but it wasn't just that. It was also understanding that when he needed to take himself out of the circuit and the grind of the circuit and that sort of a week to week, city to city rhythm can be very, very grueling and very enervating. And I think he recognized really that he wanted to kind of extricate himself from that from time to time in order to stay fresh, not just physically, but fresh mentally. And honestly, I don't think enough tennis players have taken that approach over the years. And I think it's hurt a lot of guys. And I think Roger knew that. And he also knew Pete Sampras, and heard stories about him and what happened to Pete, who was a fantastic player, number one in the world for many years and multiple Wimbledon winner and a similar game to Rogers in some respects. And Pete was just burned out by age 30, 31, did not want to travel anymore, did not want to go through the grind of the tour, and he was done. And a lot of those guys of that generation were Edberg, Becker. They were all finished pretty early. Jim Courier finished pretty early. And Roger had
I remember when Agassi won a tournament when he was early 30s, it was a big headline that he'd won a major when he was, I don't know, 31 or something like that. And that was a big deal at that time.
Precisely, Deepak. Yeah, he was 33. He was considered an old number one, which he was, but he was a guy who was, wow, he's setting new boundary, new standards for longevity in tennis. Well, look at how long Roger's played for. I mean, it's blown that out of the water. He's going back to the days of Ken Rosewall and Pancho Gonzalez and players of the past who played into their early 40s. So, but I think Roger didn't intend to go to age 40, I don't think, but he intended to play deep into his 30s. Agassi certainly gave him the idea that it was possible. And I think he also was intent on managing his body through very precise training, not overdoing it. And Roger, in an interview I did with him near the end of his career in Switzerland, I remember over lunch, we were talking about a lot of different things. And we're talking about just what advice he would give younger players when they're coming on the tour. And he used the image of the clenched fist. And the clenched fist was the idea that if you spend too much time like this, I'm holding up my clenched fist here as we speak. There's too much of that. Eventually your body would break down and your mind would break down. And you needed to find a way to let the fist open and the fingers splay and relax and be able to really let the whole organism sort of take its ease, take its rest. And I think he was very, very smart and very, very good at doing that throughout his career. He had some nice distractions as time went on with his family. But even before his kids arrived, he was already in that mode where he would sort of not stay at the player hotel all the time. He'd stay at his own hotel. Instead of sticking around the practice courts and the clubhouse, he would go into the cities that he lived in. He was visiting, and explore them. Not like, you know, maybe not like you and me, but he would go out, you know, and stroll around and look at the sights and maybe visit a museum or so. And he felt the importance of that because it allowed him to unclench his fist. And I think one of the reasons that he lasted as long as he did, and I think, as I said, what's applicable there is to all of us in intense professions we might be in, you need to take that time and not just kind of half time where you're sort of, okay, I'm still on email, I'm still doing my messages, but really break away and regenerate. And then when you go back to your workplace, in his case, the tennis tournaments of the world, you're fresh, you're eager. And in Roger's case, that's part of the reason I think he's so popular, is that he was able to really come to his workplace and his public arenas with a lot of positive energy because he knew himself well enough to pull away from it when he wasn't feeling that.
Hmm. I loved an anecdote in the book. You talk about Wimbledon 2011. You speak about Federer blowing a two-set lead with Joe Wilfried Tsonga and losing the match in the quarterfinals. And you say that he goes back to his home, Wimbledon home, puts his bags down and is rolling on the floor with the twins in a Myla and Charlene in a few minutes. And he's sort of in a different world. So that just amazes me, just building on what you just said, the ability that he led a full life. And sometimes these things can help you heal and recharge much faster than if you sort of wallowed in tennis for much longer.
Yeah. And again, I think that applies to all of us in the sense of how you're able to separate those professional disappointments from your private life. And I think it's helped many athletes that I've known to have a family on the side to kind of put things in perspective. But what's interesting about that story in particular is the proximity of the house to the courts at Wimbledon. When you're Roger Federer, you can rent a house very close to Wimbledon and the club. And so it accelerates the timeline. But I would imagine a lot of players would come back from their crushing defeat and play with their kids that evening, maybe, or the next day. But this is literally minutes after he arrives back, you know, after this defeat. And I think that's what's sort of surprising about Roger, is just the way he can change the chip so quickly in a lot of different aspects. There's a lot of great stories about him, you know, hanging out in the locker room before a match is to begin. James Blake, former American player, told me the story of just, now you're talking real estate in Switzerland, vacation with Roger, where he and Mirka were thinking about going. And then sort of the bell rings and out the door you go, and Roger's trying to bash your brains out on the tennis court minutes later. So he's somebody, I think, who's been able to change that chip. And maybe we all know somebody like that in our professional world, so you can kind of go from laughing to serious in a moment. But he was able throughout his career to really, really compress that timeline and to sort of change his mood and his world very, very quickly. And I remember talking to Ivan Ljubicic just a few weeks ago, and he was talking about that. That was one of the aspects. Ljubicic was one of his last co-coaches on the tour and former great player himself. And he said that always just amazed him about Roger, was his capacity to just shift from person to person, meeting to meeting, situation to situation, kind of seamlessly. Maybe it wasn't seamless when he was 18, but by the time the man in full was there, it was very seamless. And Ivan's like, it would just exhaust me. I would be exhausted living a day in his shoes. And he just does it as a natural thing.
And building on that, right? I think as a tennis player, you're sort of, one of the things that strikes me, great players, especially Roger, is just the agility on the court. And similarly, just the emotional agility, like you said, with David Blake, you're talking real estate in one sense, you're in a certain state of emotion, you step out, you're able to switch instantaneously and sort of tune into the right emotion at the right time. It's quite something when you see that happen in front of you.
Yeah, I don't know the adaptability in a match situation, how much it directly applies. I think it does. I've never asked him that question. That would be a very good one to understand how that sort of ability to transition quickly allows him to sort of solve problems on the court the same way. Clearly, that idea that Marc Rosset had of his processing speed would apply to that ability to sort of see an opportunity, sense a tactical shift. And one of Roger's hallmarks on the court is that he's able to sort of be very unpredictable. I remember talking to Novak Djokovic about this. This is part about this in the book. And Novak said, the hardest thing about playing Roger was the unpredictability. You never felt comfortable. You never really knew what was going to come at you in any given moment. So he always had you off balance. Whereas Rafa, you kind of knew. Rafa's gotten a little more unpredictable as time has gone on with the serve and volley and such a good volleyer. But you know, you kind of knew you were going to have to deal with that topspin forehand and Rafa settling in and ripping any short ball. But Roger there was more uncertainty there. And that was troubling to the very best in the world.
I remember on that particular note, when he was playing around with the saber, I remember Djokovic experiencing that on the other side. And really, you can really see when people get rattled when something like that happens. So I remember Djokovic getting rattled by the saber when he was playing around with it.
Yeah, that came out of a practice, just sort of goofing around, experimentation. You know, I guess it's kind of like Google with their, 90% of your work time is, or 80% of your work time is on your job and 20% outside the lines, right? That was an outside the lines moment. He was just fooling around with Severin Luti, his coach, and it worked. And he's like, well, maybe we'll incorporate this. So I think that's also a sign that he likes novelty. He likes to change things up and it keeps him fresh. And that applies to, all of us in our worlds for sure.
Even the tweener, right? I think he pulled it out against Djokovic at the penultimate point of the US Open. So I guess When I look at Federer, it looks like he's turned that into almost like a proper tennis stroke.
Yeah, the 2005 Australian Open, it bit him in the tail because he used it against Murat Safin when Roger had a match point. Safin volleyed it away for a winner and Roger ended up losing the match. So it didn't always work for him. And he wasn't the one who invented the tweener. If you go back and look at like Victor Pecci and people like that back in the day, from they were using that shot, Yannick Noah. But Roger certainly popularized it, and it does reflect his desire to make things shake things up and keep it interesting for him too.
I want to talk about coaching Roger. You know, in the book, at various points, you talk about how Roger has gone about choosing coaches at different points in time. You know, Peter Lundgren instead of Carter goes through a phase of having no coach instead of Peter Lundgren. Then Stefan Edberg, even Lubicic, Severin Luthi has been with him along the way. Can you talk a little bit about his choice of coaching and what he's sought from the coaching, if I may use the word intervention, but with a coaching partner? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's a mixture of loyalty and then need for fresh voice from time to time. And I think he was pretty good, not ruthless, but I think he was somebody who was pretty good and pretty pragmatic when he needed to make a change that he did. And he often had a situation throughout much of his career where he had two coaches because of his schedule being as it was and kind of the insanity of following a pro tennis player around for 11 months of the year. It's pretty brutal for coaches to do that as well as for players to live that life. So if you have two, you can alternate. But he, you know, It's a timeline that in a way is not entirely natural, because Peter Carter, this man we've spoken about already, this deeply influential Australian on Roger and also a very close friend, he died in his late 30s on his honeymoon in South Africa after more or less being, you know, told how great South Africa was by the Federer family, how he had to go there and went down there and just freak accident, was killed in a road accident down there on safari or heading towards safari. And that was a huge moment in Roger's life. Definitely made him a more serious person about fulfilling his potential. And that was maybe a piece we didn't discuss when we discussed the mental game and the evolution. But Peter Carter certainly, I think, would have continued to play a big role in Roger's life and career later on, even though Roger made a very difficult choice that you referred to there when he chose to go as a full-time professional. You know, in the late 1990s, he decided to choose Peter Lundgren, former Swedish pro, who was connected with all those great Swedish players of the generation, Villanders and Borgs and everybody. And he chose him over Peter Carter because he felt Lundgren had more experience at the highest level than Peter Carter had. But you know, Roger described that decision as an excruciatingly difficult one and very hard. And I think he always would have kept a connection with Peter Carter. So Peter Carter might have been somebody in his career for 20, 25 years in some way as an advisor. Didn't work out that way. He had to find new support systems after Peter Carter's death. And he's somebody that he would bring in after much consultation and much thought. He would bring in different people to be the key person in his life. He did go a period of time without a coach. When he split with Peter Lundgren after winning the Australian Open, or just before winning the Australian Open in 2004, after a great 2003 season, which was a pretty bold move considering he was breaking through, to separate from your mentor at that period was quite surprising at the time. But I think he felt like he needed to for a bunch of different reasons. I'm not sure I fully understand all of them even now after writing the book, but I think there was a need to kind of do things on his own to create the strength that comes with that. Might have been some issues with Peter off the court. I don't know. I know Roger's always denied that. So when he went off on his own, he still had some advisors within his circle, guys he was close with, a guy named Reto Stubbley, who was a friend of his, coached him. But he was really making his own decisions for well over a year. And then he hired Tony Roach, who had been a great Australian player, coached Patrick Rafter, coached Leighton Hewitt later. And he was a more traditional sort of X's and O's kind of coach, and hard work and hard yards and all that sort of thing. That lasted a certain time. And then Roger decided, I think, follow a bit the Pete Sampras model and hired Paul Anacone, who was had coached Pete Sampras throughout much of his later career. And Paul's a very gregarious, engaging, thoughtful guy, definitely not a Tony Roach type. So I think Roger, in more of his mature phase, decided he wanted more of a confidant and a person, an advisor, as opposed to somebody who would be a taskmaster by any means. And that's kind of the approach that he kept throughout the rest of the way. Severin Luthi came in around 2008, 2009, I believe, in that sort of period there, maybe even a little bit earlier. And he remained sort of Roger's advisor, hitting partner through the years, but there was always somebody else with him. Paul Anacone, Stefan Edberg, who Roger idolized as a youth and wanted to bring him in to kind of work with his idol, but he was working in concert with Severin Luthi. And then at the end, Ivan Lubicic, who was a very close friend of Roger's from the tour, good mind, good analyst of the game. I think Roger really respected him and wanted to have his influence. But it was always kind of a two-headed thing with Roger. And I think he liked that idea of a committee. Let's get together with my team, with Paganini, with the coaches of the moment, certainly Severin, and then he was Paul or Pierre at the end, Paul or Ivan, sorry, at the end. And he would have team meetings a lot and discuss best way forward. What kind of string should I be using? What kind of tactics should I be thinking about for the coming year? You know, what should my schedule be? Should I skip the French Open, the clay court season? There's a lot of, you talk about Roger with him and with his team, and there was a lot of collective decisions that were made, even though he was the guy out front and a strong position as the great player that he was. But it wasn't it's my way or the highway. He liked to feel that input. He'd take it all in, and then he would decide.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. It's fascinating to see how players pick coaches. In one of my early conversations at the podcast, I was speaking with Viren Raskina, CEO of Olympic Gold Quest. When I asked him about how they pick coaches for different players, he used the example of how they found a coach for Marie Comte.
How do you pick a coach in context to a player? So I'll answer it with Marie Comte's example.
Sure.
In 2009... women's boxing was introduced in the London 2012 Olympics for the first time ever.
Mm-hmm.
Mary was already a five-time world champion winner, but in the 46 kilograms weight category and in 48 kgs, mm-hmm. her last one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when women's boxing was announced in 2009 that it would be for the first time in the London 2012 Olympics, before that boxing was only a men's sport.
Okay.
But the least weight category for women was 51 kilos.
Mm.
So that means Marie Comte, who was originally a 46 kg boxer, had to move into 51, which is two weight categories higher.
Hmm.
It had been unheard of for a boxer to go two weight categories higher and win an Olympic medal.
Wow.
Now the challenge was, because when you're fighting in a weight category, not only you need to put on the right kind of weight, but you're fighting against taller opponents.
Sure.
Which is a major technical challenge in boxing. If you're fighting against taller opponents, that's a big challenge.
Hmm.
So we researched a lot and found out a coach by the name of Charles Atkinson, who specialized in taking fighters up weight categories.
Fascinating.
And making them into world champions.
There are three things I want to say here. Firstly, I think leaders need to think about what is the development need and find a coach who solves that need. Secondly, there's something to be said about the style of the coach and whether that style fits well with the leader. I tell my prospective clients that there are some situations where you need a tough coach who has hard conversations with the coachee and holds them accountable, even if it makes them extremely uncomfortable. I've realized that this is not something that comes naturally to me. When I look at my journey and the coaching process and where I've been able to add value, it's in those situations where people have leaned into the process and are keen to make the difference and pull me in rather than me pushing them. Thirdly and finally, I think there's something to be said about cumulative context. Federer had Severin Luthi, who was a constant all along the way through his journey, while he was changing coaches on the other end. And I think that context is powerful. When I work with leaders on long retainers as a sounding board, the cumulative context often helps me give them inputs which is contextually relevant and appropriate. At the top, I believe that knowing the context is often 80% of the work and sometimes can make all the difference. If you're finding this podcast of value, do take a moment and rate and review the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you consume the content. It will help the audiences discover our work. It will also help prospective speakers build trust with us. This will ensure that we continue to raise the bar as we move forward on this journey for the long term. Let's now get back to Chris Clary and Roger Federer. And actually, on that part, Chris, just talking about judgment, right? Whether it is judgment on the tennis court in the moment, what shot to play, depending on match situation or match context, or even judgment around key decisions. You know, should I play, should I not play? Which coach do I work with? Do you have a window into just his sense of judgment and how he made decisions? Yes, he involved others and he sort of liked to do things as a committee, but tuning into Roger a little bit, is there something about the way he, his judgment that stands out for you?
I could be wrong on this. He may cite different examples if you ask him about it, but my sense of it is that it's interesting. It's a bit of a contrast in the sense that he is such a spontaneous, creative tennis player, instinctive, but a lot of his decision-making really is deeply considered. He's not a guy who's going to make a spur-of-the-moment, off-the-cuff type of decision. He likes to think things through, really get a lot of input, like I said, and make those decisions from a carefully considered position. He's not a heat-of-the-moment type of person for that sorts of things. He may be able to tell you an example I'm not aware of, but that's my sense of it. And it's an interesting contrast. It's almost like he wanted to do the planning, do the legwork, do the research to allow himself to be spontaneous, to allow himself the freedom to feel like everything's in place, my platform's there, and I can use this now to take my leaps and on the court and do what I feel is the instinctive right thing to do. So, and I called it in the book planned spontaneity, and it sounds like an oxymoron, but I think it does apply to him, and that he would really plan to have his moments of relaxation and spontaneity.
Got it. And in the book, one of the statistics you quote is of the 128 men who played the singles at the 1999 French Open, his debut Grand Slam tournament, he was the last one playing singles on tour. You know, it's we spoke about his endurance earlier in the conversation, but just the longevity was of his journey has been startling. I guess the related question I wanted to ask you was, what can we, you know, what do we know about how he thought about the timing of his retirement? You know, how did he think about it? It's a challenge that not just elite athletes face, right? Successful business leaders face. How do you think about when to hang your boots?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I'm not sure Roger got to live that fully, that process, because I think the temptation is to say, well, he was all about the joy and the process and the enjoyment of the game and the feel of the ball on his strings and that sort of the joy of competing. But he never really had an extended period where he was losing to everybody. He was still a big factor. I mean, he had two match points to win Wimbledon in 2019 against Novak Djokovic. Probably should have won that match. Great escape by Novak, full credit to Novak. But I mean, Roger was serving, missed an ace on the first match point by a couple centimeters. So it's just one of those things. So he was 38 years old there. Yeah, around that range would have been a phenomenal thing, the biggest achievement of his career. So he was very much a factor. Goes to Australian Open in 2020, ends up getting hurt, but loses in the semifinals there. And honestly, the pandemic arrives after that. He doesn't really play full-on tennis again. So he never really had to experience what a guy like Leighton Hewitt had to experience, which is having been on top of the game, or a Jim Courier had to experience, be on top of the game and then falling away and having an extended period where you're too young to retire, but you're not really getting the results you used to get. There's huge frustrations that go with that. Roger never had to experience that. So we can always view him as he views himself, as somebody who loves tennis and played as long as the love was there, as long as his body would allow him to do it. So in a sense, the ending is an unnatural one. Because I do think if Roger's body would have allowed him to keep playing, he would have kept going for quite a bit longer, two or three more years. But would he have had the results that would have allowed him to be happy continuing? I don't know. It's hard to say. It's easy to imagine that, like, you know, you see exceptional athletes who can still move and still do what they – I mean, Ken Rosewall was able to play and succeed into his early 40s and reach Grand Slam finals during that period. But he wasn't the same depth of era and physicality. But – I honestly think Roger feels that the end came too soon, even at 41. I think he would have liked to go out with his boots on, playing another Wimbledon, maybe even winning a title. But I don't see him stopping after a victory. You know, I think he would have needed some reminders that he was mortal before he stopped, ultimately. I'm kind of rambling around here because I'm kind of thinking it through as we talk.
Yeah. But
from talking to him about it, after his last match in Laver Cup in London, it was clear that his intention was to try to come back again from the last knee operation and really give it one more good shot. And frankly, that good shot just never came, and it was a big disappointment.
Hmm.
He absorbed it. But then at the end, was he pragmatic or was he just realistic, or was it just really no choice? Because when you watch the doubles match in London when he played with Nadal the last match, you can see the shot making is still there in a lot of ways despite all the rust. Surface motion is still fluid. It still did a lot of damage. But when he has to move laterally, even in doubles, you can see the big difference with prime Roger Federer. And honestly, the way the game is now, if you can't move, you know, at a very, very high level, you're just not going to be competitive. These guys are just too good, too fast. You look at guys like Alcaraz, look at Novak, who's still so flexible and so good, and Rafa. It just can't be done. So I think Roger knew that, and that's why he called it a day.
One of the themes I want to touch upon, Chris, was his resilience. You know, one of the matches that really stand out for me, my all-time favorite Roger match is possibly the 2017 Australian Open final. Roger, Rafa, I think he'd come back from an injury or from a surgery. He was an unseeded player in that tournament and he went on to win it. And one of the finest backhand exhibitions I've seen, one-handed backhand exhibitions I've seen. What have you learned about his resilience when things are not going well for him at various points in his journey?
Yeah, so I think that's an underrated part of Roger's career. He's somebody who I think he would, like you, would put that match very high on his list. I mean, I would, if you ask him sort of the three most important matches, biggest moments of his career, that one would be on it for sure. Because it did show that he had grit and he was coming off, which for some athletes, 6 month break wouldn't be considered a huge break, but in tennis terms for him, it was. And his results before that had been dipping. He hadn't had the same success. He was still very much a relevant player at the top, but he wasn't really in Grand Slam winning position. He hadn't won a Grand Slam since 2012 Wimbledon. It had been almost 5 years when he won that Australian Open title. So that answered a lot of questions. And he was never in death spiral mode during those 5 years, but he was certainly had lost a lot of ground to Djokovic and to Nadal at different times. Other players were also emerging, like Andy Murray. So it was a time when he could have not regenerated, and he did. And I think he really took a lot of pleasure in working his way through the problem, coming back, feeling physically strong. And that match you mentioned, he was down 3-1 in the fifth set, and Rafa was playing some pretty good tennis. And it required a flurry of brilliance from him to turn that match around. And the commitment to not slicing the backhand and hitting through it, commitment to that's just zeal and love of the game, too, that he was feeling from coming back as the underdog for a change, seeded 17th instead of seeded number 1, 2, or 3. And I think he took a lot of pleasure from that. But otherwise, you know, I think Roger, you go back to the beginning when he left home at 14 to go down to Écublens in Lake Geneva at the Swiss National Training Center. The language of the day there was French, not Swiss German. And he was an outsider. Didn't speak French very well at all. And he was mocked, taunted, hazed a bit, struggled in school. That was a very hard period for him. And he always said later on that it was a huge factor in his later success, was being able to be resilient enough to get through that and come out on the other side a stronger person. I mean, it's a bit like a boarding school experience, you know, for a regular person. And I think he grew up a lot from that and took a lot of strength from that. I think the Peter Carter situation we described when Peter Carter died, Roger running through the streets of in Canada, trying to process his emotions, just overcome by grief. He used that as a launching pad to greatness, but it could easily have gone the other way, couldn't it? Could have been a lot of guilt, a lot of regrets, a lot of emotions he couldn't handle. It could have knocked him back as well. So he is somebody, I think, with his vulnerable side, is able to show consistent resilience throughout his career, and somebody also who chose to travel with his wife, Mirka, and his family of 2 and then 4 children, and hang out in the hotel and not get a good night's sleep and come out there and play a great match the next day. And Roger's never had, on a personal level, beside Peter Carter's death, to deal with some hugely debilitating thing in the prime of his career. But he did show, I think, a lot of grit.
In the book, you also talk about Federer, the businessman, right? He's one of the few sportsmen that have earned more than $1 billion USD with only about maybe 120, 130 from official prize money. Given that kind of ratio, what can we learn from Federer, the businessman, in the way he goes about leading that part of his life outside tennis?
Yeah, that's a great question. To be honest with you, Deepak, that was probably the hardest chapter I had to write. Because it's not easy to get those answers sometimes from people. And really, it is that is quite a story, because Roger was not destined to be a cash machine. Even though Switzerland obviously is a place of great affluence and business success and acumen, you know, a Swiss athlete is not ideally positioned to be a global superstar. There's not a natural home base that's going to create that passion. You have to create it outside. And, you know, if you're a British player like Andy Murray or an American player like Andre Agassi, you have a Grand Slam tournament in your country every year to generate that enthusiasm and that support. You have big, big home markets. We all know if an Indian men's player ever makes it big in singles, you know, the sky's the limit economically. It's going to be crazy when that happens. I think it will happen someday. So I think Roger had to build that brick by brick, and people who managed him really were aware of that challenge. And I think what helped him was he really made an effort to understand the business side of it. That period of time when he had no agent, he took a lot of lumps. He was frankly underpaid. He probably was not doing great things for the market. A lot of agents were actually angry because he was taking deals through his father and other advisors that were below market value in their opinion and hurting their own negotiating stances with their own players. But he was somebody who was able to, I think, take the time away from an agent to ask a lot of questions, use his curiosity, and sort of really go into meetings. He talks about coming back from tournaments and going into a business meeting about, you know, how to manage a contract or how to negotiate something. And he really learned sort of the nuts and bolts of it, because he'd heard a lot of stories about athletes who lost their fortunes and lost their money because they just didn't follow day to day. And the other thing, besides the clenched fist, that he advises young players and young athletes is understand your money, understand how it all operates, understand that financial system and how that money's coming in and where it's going, and really plug yourself into it. Even though it can seem, I think in some ways, uninspiring at times and not as much fun as whatever else you might be planning that night, it pays off in the long run. And he was very focused on that. And I think his parents also emphasized that as well. And ultimately, he ended up choosing to go back with IMG again with a different agent, a guy named Tony Godsick, who'd worked with Monica Seles and Lindsay Davenport, Tommy Haas. And Tony, frankly, has proven to be a brilliant manager of Roger's career, not just the money, but the overall image and overall way he presents. And I think together with Roger's consistent excellence and Roger's consistent, amiability and sympathy, the combination of enduring good excellence, enduring sympathy, and basically enduring elegance, which you never get tired of watching if you're a sports fan because the way the guy moves on the court, that was the killer combination. And that produced catnip for sponsors, a lot of them Swiss, but a lot of them not Swiss as well. And a lot of those deals are long-term deals, very lucrative. And even when things didn't go well for him, when Nike decided they'd had enough, and then didn't pay him what he thought he was deserving in his late 30s to renew, he ended up landing very much on his feet, signing with Uniqlo, maybe a little bit down market overall, but the deal is incredibly lucrative. And then deciding to get involved with On, the running shoe company based in Switzerland, and kind of a market share perspective, owning some stock. And that has just exploded, as you can see, on the streets of North America with all the On running shoes you see. So Roger turned that Nike rejection into two huge opportunities in apparel and shoes. And so I think it's a combination of doing your homework, having this crazy combination of skills and appeal, and not screwing up, not having the scandal, not having the mistake that destroyed his public capital and changed people's opinion of him. You've seen a lot of athletes, unfortunately, that's happened too over the years, where things just turned the wrong direction. Roger was, I think, that kind of person to begin with, but it can't be a coincidence that he went for that many years without anything really major clouding the landscape. Smart guy, and he understood it. When things did flare up, he knew how to extinguish the flames very quickly. And it wasn't by hiding, it was by addressing it.
And you actually say in that context, right, what makes him unique is not the performance on the court, but his performance in the boardrooms and corporate suites and how he delivers personalized service. you know?
I think it's the combination, Deepak, to be honest. I don't think there are many more elegant tennis players. I mean, he's a belly dancer out there in a lot of ways. He's also got the grit. There are other players who are beautiful to watch. Grigor Dimitrov. How many Grand Slams has Grigor won? None. So the elegance plus the excellence, the enduring quality, and the way he just connects with people, whether it's somebody, you know, unimportant like me, or somebody who's like the sponsor who's going to give him a $100 million deal, and or, you know, the friend of the friend who's a construction worker who wants to understand how you build a building. The way he connects with people, even though he's not somebody who's like a Nick Kyrgios who's going to go over and chat with the fan on the side of the stands mid-match, he connected with people throughout his whole career. And that's really the heart of it.
Chris, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. Given all the work you've done as a sports journalist, your understanding of Federer and several other elite athletes, what's your take on the phrase playing to potential?
That's an interesting one through the optic of Roger, really, because if you talk to some people like Günter Bresnik, one of the guys I respect the most in tennis, he's an Austrian coach, Coach Becker. He was the guy who basically molded Dominic Thiem's game into a great force. He thinks that Roger underperformed. He thinks Roger should have won 30 or more Grand Slam tournaments based on all those matches that were the match points up that he didn't convert, just based on his incredible talent level. And that's a tempting perspective because obviously he's blown two match point leads against Novak at two US Opens and one Wimbledon. And he's had some other losses along the way that were surprising at slams. Roger would say those things even out over the long run, that he won matches that he maybe wasn't destined to win as well.
True. Like the Roddick Wimbledon, the 1917. Yeah, he's had a share of.
That's one he's mentioned. And also the, you know, the match you mentioned before, the 2017 Australian with that 3-1 upper break lead, Nadal. You know, Rafa doesn't lose too many upper break leads in the fifth set. That's his argument. But I think it's actually, I'd go wider than that. And I think Roger, because of his, I think his weaknesses are also his strengths, because I think he's somebody, his tendency to take more risk probably has led to some defeats that might not have happened to some of the other guys, like a Novak or a Rafa. And yet that desire to take the risk, that desire to, you know, be spontaneous, that sensitivity that's in him, that's sort of the motor for his game and the motor for his longevity as well, because he's a guy, obviously, we talked about a lot today. He's somebody who likes novelty, likes the innovation, likes the creativity, likes to be on the edge and feel that thrill. And he's a very instinctive tennis player. So I think that sort of vulnerable side to him, the flip side of it was the innovation and creativity that kept him going for so long. Without that, he wouldn't have lasted or burned as brightly as long as he did. So I personally feel Roger did fulfill his potential in tennis, or very, very, very close. And I think he definitely fulfilled it off the court. And I think that's a part of the package in tennis. You're giving a lot of interviews, you're signing a lot of deals, you're touching a lot of people and shaking a lot of hands. And I think he really performed to potential there. And there's a lot to learn from him, probably more in that aspect than the tennis, which is pretty hard to relate to sometimes.
And we talk about success. Maybe if I could persist for another minute or two, you know, how does a person like him set goalposts, you know, when you're sort of at the cutting edge of redefining a lot of playbooks? What's your take on how people like Roger think about success?
Well, I think, again, he's somebody who's spontaneous inside the lines and more considered outside the lines. And I think he tends to think kind of medium to long term a lot. I mean, you talk to him about his schedule sometimes in the prime of his career, and he knew where he was going to be like a year and a half out. He knew his schedule. A lot of guys, it might be 6 months, 9 months. Roger like knew where what meeting he was going to be in on a day in July a year before, you know, what part of the world and what court he'd be on. And it was all very, very planned out. So that Swiss side, that sort of regimented, organized side. And then there's probably more the South African, even the Latin side to him, where it was letting it flow, letting it go. And so I think in terms of his goal setting, he seemed to be, to me, pretty methodical, pretty systematic about that. And I think he and Tony Gottsick, his long-term agent now, who interrupted his period of independence and has been his main guy for a long time, they do a lot of planning meetings, a lot of strategic thinking, and this sort of pivot to on running, pivot to Roger investing in sports companies. We haven't talked about his foundation at all today, but that's a huge part of his future plans as well. Roger Federer Foundation, many athletes and stars have foundations. He started his when he was quite young. His family's quite involved. He wants to really make an impact with education around the world for youth, primary school in particular. He's made a lot of connections with Bill Gates through tennis exhibitions and just general, you know, picking his brain. That's not by coincidence. Roger likes to sort of find a mentor for the next chapter in his life, get to know them, enjoy that connection, but also learn from it. And I think that's something he's done throughout his career. It's been a pattern.
Fascinating. Chris, thank you so much for making the time on the podcast. Real pleasure talking to you.
Deepak, I love your subject and I love your style. So thanks very much for having me.
We've all seen Roger being fluid on court and move around so beautifully. If there's one thing that struck me in this entire conversation, it's the fluidity with which Federer was able to walk tight ropes across multiple dimensions. Planned and spontaneous, deciding with heart and head, handling peak intensity and longevity, spending time on work and family, stormy from within and composed on the exterior, being a great tennis player and a shrewd businessman, and much, much more. So much to learn and emulate from this amazing human being. I hope you enjoy the 100th conversation at this podcast. We're really excited about how far we've come on this journey and plan to keep on marching for the years to come. If you're seeing value, do share this with your networks and take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you consume this. Thank you, and look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the podcast. Bye now.